extend Walt Baker opportunity to welcome the group. He missed it last time, and but so we'll give it an opportunity now. So Walt, if you'd like to take a minute, we'd like to offer you the floor.
Stand up over here. Well, it's good to be here. I think I got here just in time for the food. So, I don't know what the circumstance was that didn't allow me to be here. I think I was out of town during your first meeting, but I want to just relate just a little anecdote, I guess, as I look around the room and I see who is seated at the table and other stakeholders that are involved here. My son-in-law had some kind of activity with his church that he needed to organize some volunteers to do whatever. I don't know what it was, an activity or dinner or something. So he went and organized that, and later on I asked, well, how did it go? Was it successful? And he said, yeah, and thank goodness for the STPs that were there that made it successful. And he used the STPs. I didn't know exactly what that meant. I said, well, who are the STPs? And he says, it's the same 10 people. So with any kind of volunteer organization or group that you get together, it's kind of interesting as we have various initiatives. It's the same 20 people, perhaps. And there's many of you that have been collaborators with us in some other important investigative work that we need to do. So I'm appreciative. Maybe we ought to have some shirts made up for the STPs that are around this table. But you are the ones that are committed, that you're engaged and interested. You find this important. And so on behalf of the Division of Water Quality, I want to extend our appreciation for you volunteering your time for this important initiative. As I look over our administrative rules, and here's the administrative rules for the Division of Water Quality, and they govern everything we do water quality-wise. They set the parameters for our loan program, for our NPDES permitting program, for groundwater, for on-site wastewater disposal in septic tanks, for underground injection control, for certifying operators. Every aspect of our program is here in this book. And it drives our day-to-day activities in the Division of Water Quality. The most important aspect of these administrative rules is R317-2, and that is what you're engaged in working on. That are water quality standards that will allow us to set the parameters whereby all other aspects of our rules are governed. So this is a standard-setting group. We've never embarked upon such a far-reaching initiative relative to our water quality standards. So we're glad that we've got the experts here that can participate, and at the end of the day, I think we will have administrative rules governing our water quality standards that will serve the citizens of the state of Utah for many, many, many years to come. So again, thank you on behalf of our agency for your participation and contribution, and I wish you good luck in your efforts. So thank you.
Okay, thanks, Walt. Anybody have any questions for Walt?
That wasn't part of this presentation, I didn't think, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. All the food there is available, Walt, with the exception of the sugar cookies. Those are reserved for the chair.
Spoken for already.
All right,
thank you.
Thanks, Walt. Let's go around the room, see who we are. Bill Bulmer with the Division of Water Quality, and I do the standards for the state of Utah.
And I'm David Moon. I'm with the U.S. EPA in Denver, and I'm in the Water Quality Unit, and I'm on the Water Quality Standards team. And one of my jobs is to work with Bill on the Utah Water Quality Standards issues.
I'm Howard Thomas with the Utah Farm Bureau, and I'm here representing both Todd Bingham and Mark Peterson today. Mark's in Europe and Todd's in Logan. And I don't know who's furthest away from reality.
I'm Lloyd Gowell with the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food.
Carmen Daly, I'm with the Division of Wildlife Resources, and I'll be moving regularly. Craig Walker's going to be the alternate. And the impact analysis coordinator for the state.
Leland Myers with Central Davis Sewer District. Brad Rasmussen with the Utah Food Industries Association.
Thank you. I hadn't figured out exactly where I was yet. So.
I got you covered, bud.
Thanks.
Gerard Yates with Central Utah Water.
Lisa Kirshner with Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer and Pat at Kennecott, Utah Mining Association member. Carrie Rubelman with Kleinfelder on behalf of the Utah Manufacturers Association.
Florence Reynolds with Salt Lake City Public Utilities.
Barrett Fry with the Utah Rivers Council.
And I'm Paul Raymond, Trout Unlimited.
Ian McCauley with the Division of Water Quality. My job is to keep up with Bill and keep him up.
That's hard. Okay. Well,
we have student guests.
We need to start over here with Dave Lamb.
Dave Lamb, Division of Water Quality.
And Jeff Oscar Miller with the Division of Water Quality.
Nicholas von Stackelberg with Stantec.
Harry Gibb with the Division of Water Quality.
Reed Oberndorfer with Central Utah Water.
Mark Quilter with the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food.
Tom Toth,
Division of Water Quality.
My name is Don Summit. I work with Miller Beef.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. Dave Moon, like Dave indicated, is my counterpart. We've had a long-standing relationship over the last 15, 16 years. Dave and I have been working together. And it's a very interesting relationship. Sometimes it's out of love, and then sometimes not so much. But as I've matured, you know, we get along with Dave. We get along really great now, and he's a great resource for us, and I hope vice versa. So we would like to turn some time over to Dave to talk about what's this relationship between the feds and the states, and whose standards really are these? Are they the feds, or are they ours that the Fed says we have to adopt? And how does this all work? And what are the issues on EPA's platter? We'll talk about that briefly for this triennial review, because eventually we'll come back and discuss these. Today basically is a day of anti-degradation that we talked about at our last meeting, but I wanted to have Dave kind of give you an overview of how we relate and what our relationships are. What's his relationship with the environmental community, and how's that all fit together? Is that enough?
That'll be funny. people ask me what do you do? And mostly what we do in the standards program is we work with our state and tribal counterparts to help them with their standards issues. If there's going to be a rulemaking to change standards, we'd like to participate throughout, including the pre-rulemaking and during rulemaking. We'd like to help them identify potential issues to be addressed. We'd like to help them identify the options that can be used. We try to explain the federal requirements, of which there are some. But generally, there's also, with each requirement, there's flexibility. And there's more than one way to meet the requirement. And so we help them, we try to help them understand what their options are, understand the flexibility. We do things like gather examples of what other states have done, and try to help them understand the advantages and the disadvantages of different options for meeting the requirements. The main thing for us is for the state ultimately to adopt something that does meet the requirements so that we can approve it. But a lot of the decision making about which option to pick is, you know, that's the state's job. That's why the Clean Water Act gave states and authorized tribes, you know, the primary responsibility for making those decisions. Those decisions about which option to pick are not EPA's job, and we understand that. We do generally provide recommendations of which option we think is most appropriate, and sometimes we give reasons. And that's not meant to be a statement that this is the only choice, because usually, you know, as I said, there's flexibility. And then once the state makes its decision and submits revisions to us, we are required to act on it, to either approve or disapprove. Hopefully, what we're going to get is an approval. And happily, right now, Utah standards are fully approved because of hard work by Bill. So we're pretty happy with the existing standards. But I think there are probably some opportunities to make the existing standards even better. So that's, I think, why we're all here today. Bill asked me to quickly run through our issues. And this is brainstorming. I'm still developing what our issues are. Mostly I wanted to come here today to hear what everyone had to say, because I thought, well, that's going to really help us figure out what the problems are, and it's going to help us figure out what issues we want to raise. And So, but I did sit down on Monday and look through the standards and look through some of our old comments and thought about things a little bit. So this is very preliminary. This is just brainstorming. Some of these issues may or may not be priorities for Bill. I haven't had a chance to discuss it with him. And, you know, I want to do that. Anyway, quickly, on the merit criteria, we have a problem with Class 3C and 3D waters because there's no chronic ammonia criterion, which is a problem because the species most sensitive to chronic ammonia, most chronically sensitive to ammonia, are invertebrates. There's really no technical basis for drawing a distinction between 3A, 3B, and 3C or 3D. There might be a basis on a site-specific level to recalculate the national criteria, but I think there's a strong argument that chronic ammonia standards are needed for all state waters.
Can I ask you a question? If you're going to require an ammonia standard, what are you going to base that on in a 3C or 3D if you're doing it with invertebrates? Are there significant invertebrate studies like you were with the fish?
Well, we have a national criteria recommendation that Utah has adopted for 3A and 3B waters. And it's driven by the sensitivity of invertebrates. So the existing Utah standard could be applied to 3C and 3D waters.
There have been a number of those studies. I don't know whether that's appropriate.
Yeah. Well, yes, the criteria are based on toxicity studies for a wide range of species, and the ones that are most sensitive to ammonia are invertebrates.
And is this just the Gold Book analysis, Bill?
It's the 1999 update to the Gold. The Gold Book was in 86. We have an updated ammonia analysis that features a much larger data set than was used in driving the Gold Book value.
And this ammonia thing will be something that we're going to address. So all Dave's doing is just giving us his laundry list at this point.
But that's probably our highest priority, frankly. I think, again, there's no technical basis for not having a chronic ammonia standard for 3C and 3B waters. Now, in situations where there are natural or irreversible concentrations, such as some of these TDS impaired waters, perhaps, one of our questions is whether or not there's a need to clarify or develop a methodology that should be used to derive criteria to reflect that attainability question. What's the highest attainable level of water quality? And what's the process and what kind of method which should be used to derive those criteria on a site-specific basis? For Class 1C waters, the existing standard is 10 micrograms per liter, and I believe the MCL is 5 micrograms per liter.
For which trailer?
Cadmium. So I think maybe that's something that can be updated, although usually for cadmium it's the aquatic life criteria that's the driver. I don't know that that's going to affect too many permits, but that might be something that can be looked at.
Mm-hmm.
Add a nitrite criterion, again, to protect Class 1 seawaters.
Nitrite?
Nitrite. It's an MCL for that. I don't know why. I don't know if there's a reason for why that wasn't adopted. Is there a need to clarify the allowable frequency of exceedance provisions of any criteria, such as DO and pH and things like that? I think maybe that would be helpful at the time of 3A/3D listing.
Well, that's something that Tom Toole will be working with.
Okay, good. And then with respect to the recreation standards, a few years ago, for a long time, the 2A and 2B classifications had the same criterion. And then several years ago, I'm seeing some puzzled looks. Several years ago, it was a two-tiered system, so that the 2A waters have a slightly more protective illness rate than the 2B waters. Now, we consider both to be a fairly protective level, but there is now a difference, whereas before there wasn't. So one issue is whether or not there are some 2B waters that should have that more protective level of protection based on the amount of usage they're getting, the recreational usage.
Well, this is an issue when we're talking in the future. It's our number three priority.
Okay.
When we're talking about full face immersion, and what parameter and what's the difference between that between not using hover or watercraft or water skiing or swimming? And so this group will discuss that as well.
Okay. And then there's a footnote for the E. coli standard to explain how it can be applied where there are wildlife sources, and we just have some language changes. This one is more of an editorial suggestion of how that footnote could be clarified, not to change the substance of it, just to make it more clear. With respect to the single sample criteria, the EPA E. coli criteria are based on a hypothetical distribution of values, and that distribution has a geometric mean of 126 per 100 milliliters. When you're talking about an 8 illness per 1,000 user illness rate. Now, what have come to be known as the single sample criteria are really percentiles in that distribution. 75th percentile, 82nd percentile, 90th and 95th. But they're associated with the 126, same statistical distribution. And many states adopted those as not to be exceeded values. But when you take the distribution and you take a number that was a percentile in that distribution, say the 75th percentile, and you make that number not to be exceeded, you're essentially requiring that the distribution shift so that now the 75th percentile is a not to be exceeded value, and you're changing the stringency of the national criteria recommendation. So, and there's been a lot of confusion about those numbers. But what we're saying now is that states have the option to adopt a 75th percentile value and apply it as the 75th percentile value, such that your monitoring data, you would compare the 75th percentile of your observations to the 75th percentile. Because the idea is, then if your 75th percentile observation is less than the 75th percentile in the criteria document, then you're achieving the intended level of protection. And you would expect that the 126 number would be met as well. So this is an option. But in Utah, where they adopted the 95th percentile number, which is a higher number, it's adopted as a maximum. And so the existing single sample criteria, to a small degree, there's this thing about the 95th percentile is now a not to be exceeded. So our position on those criteria is that they're protective, and in fact, it's more protective than the 126 as a geometric mean. Having said that, there are problems with using single samples because of all the variability in ambient waters, because of the problems with the analytical method, which there's problems with the analytical method in terms of getting a real precise number. So making decisions based on one sample is problematic. But having said all that, one of our questions is, should Utah single sample criteria be revised in some manner, for example, consistent with our recommended number for designated beach, moderate full body contact, or lightly used full body contact? I have a feeling I've confused everybody, so we can come back to that one.
Can I ask a question about it, though?
Yes, sir.
When you're saying the 126 is the 75th, right?
No.
It's a distribution of values. The 126 is the geometric mean.
Right, and that's the 95th percentile?
And then that number,
the mean.
We assumed a distribution
right.
And calculated percentile values that go with the geometric mean.
And our number is 126.
It's a geometric mean.
And then that assumes a maximum of?
8 illnesses per 1,000.
I know, but what's the maximum? You talked about a maximum number.
It's a 95th percentile.
On that curve.
Okay.
For 8 illnesses, which I think is 576 per something per 100. So it's a bigger number because it's a 95th percentile.
Right.
Then that skews the whole distribution when you use that as a not to exceed.
And it's adopted as a
maximum. That's why it's a problem.
It's adopted as a maximum. It's not a problem.
Well, it's more conservative.
There's a margin of safety there.
Yeah.
Because you've got the last 5%, which you're not allowed.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question?
Yes,
also?
Ma'am.
If we're looking at that as a geometric mean, how then does the state, if the state adopted that, how do we address instantaneous problems? Somebody dumps something into a river, and it exceeds that mean.
Could I exercise chairmanship here?
And you don't want to discuss that?
Not right now. These are all issues that we're going to get to, and I think if we get started talking about in the details of each one of these, we're going to we're going to shy away from getting anti-degradation, which was our goal.
I'll join you later on this one.
Yeah. We'll talk to you later, but is that all right, Florence?
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
So I have an answer to that question. And then on anti-degradation, one of our questions is, how does the anti-deg method apply to the Great Salt Lake? Does that need to be clarified? How does the anti-deg method apply to parameters for which degradation is proposed, but there's no numeric criteria, we only have a narrative? And is there an opportunity to clarify what, if anything, is required by anti-deg in that scenario? And then, should the off-ramps for anti-deg review be clarified or streamlined or narrowed? So those are our three issues so far on anti-deg. Use classifications for class 3C waters. Question is there a need to review those waters to determine whether or not a class 3B use is more appropriate? Has anyone looked at the fish communities in those segments lately to see whether or not they might be more appropriately be a 3B? Should this classification be reserved for intermittent or low flow segments that have limited fish communities?
Yeah, we haven't even looked at that.
And to have a 3A waters, which is cold water, 3B is warm, and then 3C would be warm, but it's very limited fish community.
That was the original intent when it was all put together back 30 years ago.
And then with respect to 3D, should that use classification be assigned to most or all waters statewide to reflect that most or all waters support water-oriented wildlife in some fashion?
It is by default if it's not listed. Or on the beneficial use list.
By default, to the streams that aren't otherwise identified.
Right.
But I'm talking about the streams that are identified.
Oh, add 3D to
the 3D, just to clarify that.
Wouldn't the criteria that apply to 3A or 3B or 3C be equivalent to or greater or more stringent than?
Yes, 3D? I don't think it would change the level of stringency. I think it would only be to clarify that the intention is that wildlife are protected too. So it's not a. It's not something that would change permits, I don't believe.
Okay.
It
would
clarify that the standards protect wildlife statewide.
Okay.
And then finally, with respect to the narrative standard, should the narrative standard be expanded to include a component addressing biology? I think Utah's already done a lot of work developing their biological assessment methods, and in fact, waters are being listed using biological data. So I'm just raising the question, would it be helpful to have a narrative biological standard to point to as the basis for making those decisions? And that's all I have so far, but this is just brainstorming. I don't want anyone to get mad at me, and we're just trying to flag some issues for discussion.
Good. Get your food on the way out. Okay, thank you very much. So this is where we are kind of with EPA. These are the kind of conversations that we have with EPA. What's on your mind, Dave? And what do you think, Bill? And now we've brought him into this open process. So this will be great for all of us. One thing that we need to do is make sure everybody has all the handouts. So do you want to go for a little bit of that as a part of the beginning of your presentation, Yi-Ying?
Sure.
Let's just go through our handouts and see.
Okay. Does everyone have agenda? If any of you couldn't find the meeting information, they are on that desk over there, okay? Agenda. And then also, we have a meeting summary from the previous meeting. And this just provided to you as information for those who did not attend a previous meeting, but you read the meeting summary and know what we had discussed in the previous meeting. And also, each of you should have a contact list. And if you notice any mistakes on the contact list, please let me know. I try to, make the contact list as thorough as possible. And now, I think what I'd like to do is, I'm going to cover what handouts I have for now. When you get to anti-deg, for the next item, I'm going to talk about the overview of the proposed changes that was presented to the Water Quality Board last year in October. Leland is familiar with this because Leland was in that meeting. But I think for the benefit of this group, just give you some historical aspect of what was proposed. And then I think my purpose is just give you an overview. And we don't have any, you know, we have not decided where we stand on the proposed changes. So the purpose of the presentation is not say we propose this. This was proposed, and we decided to pull it back. And then for this group to go over the, you know, issue in the next 6 months to decide which ones would be okay, we just say that's fine, we agree with it, put it aside, and then we identify the hot topics, we'll go in detail and discuss it and come up with a recommendation so we can take it back to the Water Quality Board probably January or February 2008. So,
Sure. The last meeting, you passed out a response to comments on the internal review and asked to take them back if it's the wrong version. Is there a final version of response to comments that went out?
I think the ones I emailed to the group,
that was the final.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I didn't print out that because I thought, you know, that's history and there's no point to go back because now we just start from fresh.
So
now, if you can find this color copy, that's kind of thick up here. This is the what's on our website. I'm going to just go through the changes quickly. And then, so if you don't mind, and there's another page, it's just one single page summary of previously proposed changes. So let's just have these two. I'm going to walk you through these two. So let's look at the big document. This is what was proposed. This big document, if you can check, you know, open your page 3, I'll just give you a brief explanation of, you know, the changes and the rationale why we proposed it. On page 3, we propose to change it to eliminate the duplicate language between E and F. So you see the red font is to delete the existing, you know, language, and the green is what's added. Okay? And on page 4, Phil, if you can, Phil, next slide, please.
Okay.
On page 4, these are the proposed changes to the classifications of the Escalante River. You notice on the bottom we have some typos. We misspelled it as Escalante. We're going to fix that. So we kind of get a lot of X's here. And then the reason for this change is just so if we look at the map, the next slide has a map. What we propose to do is the current rule basically lists the complete Escalante River as a 3C. What we propose to do is from the Boulder Mountain here, we proposed from the Boulder Creek down all the way to Lake Powell. We would like to list it as 3B. And then above Boulder Creek, we said if it's an unidentified creek, we'll list it as a 3B. Just everything is 3B, except the ones that's clearly listed. And you'll see on the bottom of page 4, we identify a specific creek, and we're going to propose to these defined tributaries as 3A. Undefined one, we will list it as 3P. So that's, and then if you have any questions, say, what's the rationale of making these changes? There is a document here, it's provided by the TMDL section. Carl Adams is the manager of TMDL section. He is in another meeting right now, but he will join us later. So if you have any questions regarding the TMDL issues or the stream segment, reclassifications, Carl would answer the question when he gets here. But this document The title says Rationale for Site-Specific Criteria and Use Attainability Analysis. This is a has detailed TMDL information to support our decision at that time to make these changes. I'm not going to go through this today, just provide this to be, you know, for your information. So read as your reading pleasure. Okay, now we go to page 15. The next slide, please. So Oasis Creek is a tributary of Bear River. On page 15, we propose to make the changes because the Deseret Range High Ditch Diversion is a man-made structure that was in place since 1800s. And this man-made structure diverts the Bear River flow to an irrigation ditch. So what we're proposing now is to keep whatever is upstream of this diversion, we'll keep it as a 2B and 3A. And what's downstream of the diversion, we want to change it to 2B and 3C and 3D because below this diversion, this part, this segment of stream doesn't get much flow from Bear River. It's mostly groundwater infiltration. So that was the reason. And page 16, on the top, we have State Canal. We're adding State Canal to be defined in the water quality standards because we have been doing monitoring on State Canal, but it's not defined in our water quality. So in the water quality standards, we're just adding State Canal. You'll notice the footnote number one is existing oxygen site-specific criteria. Now, page...
The State Canal gets its water from the Jordan River. So we just continue that over.
Okay, page 18, about two-thirds way down, there's one line, says lake and reservoirs. All lakes and any reservoirs greater than 10 acres. Our intent at that time was we would like to cover more lakes on our radar screen. So originally it was 20 acres. So we proposed to change the cutoff, you know, size to 10 acres. Page 20. And page 20 is we propose to move the maximum value for E. coli to a pollution indicators. I think we'll get into detailed discussions when we get to the E. coli part. For now, I'm just laying it out, say this was proposed.
And on page 20 also, at the top of page 20, is where we're going back. We're recommending going back to the original 1200 on irrigation. And so that's on the table as well, and we'll be talking about that.
Okay, and on page 20, total dissolved solids, the existing regulation, there are two numeric standards for the, is it 3C? Oh, no, class 4 water for irrigation water. So we have irrigation water at 1,200 and for stock watering at 2,000. And at that time, we proposed to eliminate the stock watering 2,000 numeric standard and to go with one single standard with 1,200. The rationale for that time was we have two numeric standards for the same beneficial use, and we did not define which water bodies specifically are for stock watering or which water bodies specifically for irrigation. So when Tom Tool is doing water quality assessment, it's, you know, it creates difficulties in determining which water body is impaired, which water body is not. So that was the rationale. But I'm going to just defer any further discussion to later on when we get to TDS. And on the bottom of page 20, that's where we want to move. We wanted to move the bacterial E. coli maximum level to under the pollution indicator. Page 21. On top of page 21, what we proposed was to remove the language of specifying lab equipment. Instead, we wanted to specify the lab methods. And then in the middle of page 21, we recommended, you know, we wanted to remove the footnote number 4. The rationale was this footnote would let the water users to set the water quality standards. And we, you know, there was concern from the water quality board members saying, you know, that's appropriate. That's the rationale. But, you know, now we just pull everything back, we'll reevaluate it. And then the next part is about the Duchesne River. There are two creeks. I think that's the next two slides, Bill. Antelope Creek and Indian Creek. These changes are made based on the Duchesne TMDL, which has been approved by EPA. Okay, page 22. We try to make corrections on the name. You can see we want to strike out, let me try this, Quichapa Creek. And that was a mistake. The Quichapa Creek is not even part of the Muddy Creek. So we correct the name. It's just a wrong name. And on the bottom of page 22, the Paria River, we propose to change these standards based on the TMDL, Paria River TMDL approved by EPA. And what, in the very bottom of the page 22, where it talks about Price River and tributary, and talking about the TDS standard. And Bill, if you can bring up that map. Okay, here's a map. It's hard to read, but if you can see the red line, that's a 7,500 feet elevation contour line. And then there's a green line, very close to the red line, that's the 7,200 feet elevation. And the rationale of this change to provide a higher TDS level for a site-specific criteria was we found out the geological formation of what's called Mancos Shale geological formation, it tends to release a lot of TDS naturally, you know, uncontrollable, you know, sources of TDS. So we map the Manco Shell's elevation, and we found it is quite similar to the 7,200 feet elevation contour line. This formation is kind of tilted to the side, so it's up high on the left-hand side, and it's low on the right-hand side. So part of the changes, we stick with 7,200 feet elevation, and part of the changes, we say 7,500 elevation, it's all based on the elevation of the Mancos Shale formation. Okay, next one, page 23. On the bottom of page 23, we proposed to use total phosphorus as a pollution indicator. And then on the bottom of page 23, we also mentioned that we want to specify E. coli from natural sources. We add the language mammalian, wildlife, and birds. On top of page 24, we try to clarify that mixed E. coli contamination situations, the human components must be accounted for utilizing the natural resources. And then on the same paragraph in the end, we specify that we want to use Quantitrate 2000 procedures as a field method. I know Florence had some comments, you know, sending some comments when we put this out for public notice. But I think we'll just defer that discussion when we get to E. coli. Page 26. Page 26, we are adding thiazinol, and page 27, we are adding nonylphenol, these two parameters to our numeric standards. And Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, this is based on the recommendation or the recommended
Yeah, these are recommendations coming down from EPA.
Okay. All right. Page 29. We are specifying the lab methods instead of lab equipment. Page 30, on the bottom. We propose to use total phosphorus as a pollution indicator instead of numeric water quality standard.
Well, we've never had it as a numeric standard.
Oh,
the reason that we have the as a pollution marked in there is because some places in the rule it talked about phosphorus as an indicator. Some of the other places says it was a pollution indicator. So we just made it uniform by calling them all a pollution indicator.
Okay, page 31, 32, and 33 are just typographic changes to make it easier to read. In the middle of page 33, the title, table 2.14.5, we are adding state canal to the site-specific criteria for Jordan River.
Let me take this back one page. Page 32, also back on page 31. The reason we're making these changes, we're moving away from scientific notation and basically putting it into an Excel spreadsheet notation, which makes it a lot easier for everybody to use and manipulate.
Okay, page 36. It's a typographical correction. And page 37, we're adding the diazinal into our numeric standards. So that's all the changes that's proposed. But I think in the future, when we get a chance, I'd like to come back to revisit these changes with this group. If there are issues that this group think, yeah, we don't have any problem with, you know, the proposed change, just go with it, then we can put those aside. We don't need to come back to visit it. We may just, we plan to bring those issues back to the Water Quality Board later. But then we can identify what issues we want to really talk about it, and we don't agree with what was previously proposed, and then we can, you know, come up with new recommendations. That's it. Any questions? No? Bill?
Okay. Anybody have any comments at this point that they'd like to talk about? Things that popped into your mind that's on your radar screen real quick? That kind of popped up there and you want to get it off, then let us know what it is and then we'll make a notation of it and be sure we bring it up in the future. Okay.
I guess I had just a clarification. So we mentioned that if we don't have any issues with these proposed changes, I'm not as familiar with the classification system, so I'm going to have to go back and look at this stuff again. Is there a timeline we're looking at, or...
You know, the purpose of this is just, we've got all sorts of folks from different backgrounds and also all sorts of folks with different hot buttons. And if we can just gather them all together so that they can be all analyzed and then discussed as a group.
Okay, so there is a...
And then hopefully our idea...
I think you're asking about the schedule.
Yeah, but I don't think we really do have a schedule. I think what we want to do is to get as good as we can get it, come to as much consensus among us all that we get it, and then Division of Water Quality will put it all together and we start talking to EPA to finalize their comments as well as the internal comments we've had, and then we go to public hearing and that's where it all starts officially.
But there is a public, you are planning on doing that in January, so we are kind of on a schedule.
Well, we are on a schedule. It's not like it's totally open-ended. I'm going to let Harry address that for just a second.
Yeah, we do, as we talked about the last time, we do have two major focuses. One, we'd like to begin rulemaking the early part of the year, January, February, to undertake some of the things that we think are, we can come to quick resolution or easily answers that we think would help us in terms of conducting business. I think some of the, as we go through this process, there are definitely long-term components. That we envision that we're going to have discussions and negotiations and solidifying a position that are going to be long after February. And so what we want to do is identify those things that we can quickly resolve and then, of course, at the same time move into those that need a lengthy discussion because of the various facets and complexity of them. and make sure that when we do come to a resolution and answer, we have what's appropriate and as acceptable as possible prior to going to public hearing, public comment.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we would like to encourage everybody to do, no matter what your position is to say, hey, wait a minute, guys, I've got a real problem with this, or whatever that issue may be.
Well,
or, hey, guys, I don't understand what this means. Help me out.
And so should I do that in the next few weeks? Or
do it within the next few minutes. So we're totally open.
There you go. Hey, you used to have an inscription about the classification in the rule. That's just something that you...
Rules are hard to read sometimes. And so, you know, we're okay with taking a few minutes and saying what we think that really means. That's not a problem.
I didn't see it in here. What is
a 3A, 3B?
Is it in there?
It's in there. It's in the first.
What I would recommend is we handed out some of the complete, you know, copy of the 3.
During the first 5 pages.
Okay, that's what I was. I didn't realize that I should have. Mm-hmm.
You haven't memorized this yet?
Yes. I knew it.
So. You memorize it by now.
So I think we do have extra copies, and for those ones who didn't get a copy last time, feel free to grab a copy. And then.
Okay, let's move forward.
Bill, can I just follow up on what Carmen said?
Sure.
I wonder, you know, just... idea, I wonder what you think of. Here's a list, kind of like a brief list of what's proposed. Would it be a good idea for each of you just look at this list quickly and say, check it out. I don't really care about this. I'm okay with it. But pick the ones, hey, I don't think this should go as it is, to identify what's important for you. Then we come back next time and we kind of eliminate the ones that we don't really need to spend time on. Would that make sense?
Could we email it to you so we have a little time to look into some of these?
Yes.
I don't think I could do this in the next few minutes.
No, we're not asking you to do that.
But you gave us a deadline, then we could identify the easy
ones. I'm suggesting by next meeting.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Lisa.
I have a process question.
Okay.
I guess I'd just like to understand what constitutes consensus and
we don't
how
know yet.
You make the determination in terms
well,
of how you go to rulemaking and whether you go
I
to rulemaking.
I think we all need to understand that this group is not, we're going to have a vote. We're not going to do that. We're going to try to get as much consensus as we can. Because certain positions may not be able to come to consensus between the different ends of the spectrum. And we'll just have to deal with that. But
we
this
being
group
Division
be,
of Water Quality staff?
Pardon?
We being Division of Water Quality staff?
Staff. The staff will bring everything together as best they can. That's basically me and Ying Ying. And then once we come to a consensus on where we think things mostly are, it goes up to Harry and Walt. And finally, it'll go to the Water Quality Board.
And then
it'll be through the whole public hearing process that we've always done in the past.
I think Lisa brought up a good question that we have not talked about it, but I always wonder, it may reach a point where within this group that everybody expressed their, you know, rationale and their reasons, and people hear all different aspects, but when there's a time you cannot reach consensus, how would this group, I'm not thinking about as a division, I'm thinking about this work group, this group, how do you come up to make a recommendation? And I'm just putting this out for the work group to think about it.
Well, It'll generate as we go, I think, is the best answer to that. Is Harry?
Well, I think at least brings up an important point, and I think that we discussed that briefly where Ying said, and that is, what are the options that this group could consider? Is it a simple majority? Is it, as you pointed out earlier, Bill, yourself, is it a recommendation with a majority of report associated with that, with the minority report showing at least what some of the various ideas of the groups are, so that the Water Quality Board would then have a point of reference to look at relative to because they surely value the input of this group. That's one of the primary reasons we put it together, is that we want to be transparent, but at the same time, we definitely want to solicit what this group feels, because they represent a broad spectrum stewards and variety of groups out there. So I think at some point in time, maybe that's now, somehow we need to come to grips with that before you get too far down, because if you get too far down, then it tends to shape, and maybe erroneously shape, how you're going to make your recommendation.
Yeah, Leland?
Yeah, I was going to say, you might want to send out to everyone what was done for the Great Salt Lake Steering Committee. They have a definition as to what constitutes consensus. I think it's 2/3 and 3/4. I don't remember which one it is. And there is the minority interest can still express a minority opinion if it goes as a recommendation to the Water Quality Board.
Yeah.
So you may want to grab that information and send it out.
I expect that as we get into each one of these specific items, that those kind of questions will start to gel, because all of a sudden we're going to be at a decision point. And so I would say let's just move forward and see how it all develops, with keeping what you had in mind, Lisa.
Yeah, maybe by the end of the day you'll know whether or not consensus is ever going to happen, right?
You'll find out. That's for sure. All right, let me move forward.
Bill, before we ask,
yeah, please.
I'd like to say, the way it was described to me when I kind of agreed to participate here in a very preliminary form, it wasn't like a final decision, was this was more like an advisory panel, not necessarily that we were going to try to come up with one unified recommendation, because it is a very diverse group. And I think that that's a very practical approach. So I would like to have us address this issue sooner rather than later, so that everybody knows kind of what the expectation is, because I think it'll change the way people approach issues and the way we prepare and talk among ourselves. So leaving it unanswered is going to lead to some discomfort, I believe.
That's the exact same thing that the Selenium and the White Great Salt Lake Work Group is. It's an advisory group, and it has those same kind of format. So if you get that, I'm sure
that might be.
It's going to be similar to what we're going to want to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, so now we have ideas on the table. Harry mentioned maybe a majority recommendation, a minority recommendation, you know, at the same time. And Leland mentioned 2/3,
75%. Well, it's written up for this, uh-huh, for the Great Salt Lake Steering Committee, and so you might want to just look at that. It would provide you with a good starting point.
So how about this? The action item is I'll do the research on the Great Salt Lake Steering Committee, you know, their ground rules, and I'll bring back, and maybe in the next meeting we'll talk about whether this work group will agree, say that's the... That's how we would define reaching consensus.
Okay. Thank you all.
Bill?
Yes?
A question on this item 13.12 on page 18.
Of the big handout?
Yeah. It talks about lakes and reservoirs. All lakes and reservoirs are greater than 10 acres. Not listed in 13.12. It used to be 20 acres or larger. How many of those are there, and how many of those would be simply agricultural or other impoundments along streams that may or may not even be streams, you know, irrigation systems, that kind of thing? Is that, and then I don't see it listed on this.
That specific question came, the answer to that lies with the TMDL section. They made that recommendation a year ago to change our water quality standards.
But the answer to your question is, in the state code, it stipulates that if it's entirely contained within private property, it's not a classified water. Okay. So a stock watering pond would not be classified if it's on your property.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I missed your question.
So that's sort of the question. How does this impact the agricultural people who have?
It's only if it's the domain of the state. Okay. And it wouldn't be if it's an individual stock watering pond.
Okay. All right. At our meeting last time, the one thing that we all decided that we'd talk about first that we'd try to tackle that was the top of our list, the first would be anti-degradation. And then if we had some time, we might be able to talk about TDS. I don't think we're going to talk about TDS today. I don't think we're going to have time. I prepared a short, about a 9-slide presentation on TDS, or on the anti-degradation. This is one of your handouts. And if you'd like to go ahead and refer to that while I pull us through this, then we'll move forward to an Excel spreadsheet, a copy of which you have, that has to do with the Mayfield Anti-Degradation Level 1 Review. And you should all have one of that. So if you could have those handy, we'll kind of go through those.
Bill, can I ask a process question?
I'm not going to get up and give my presentation today in the next time because of the timing. So I'm trying to be respectful by asking. Would you rather that we ask questions as you go through or stake out turf?
I'd prefer that you ask questions as we go so everybody, really more than one with your question. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm all for breaking immediately.
Okay.
As we mentioned last time, our water quality standards are based on four major principles, and I refer that to the legs of the stool. And the one we're going to talk about today is the anti-degradation policy. So what is it? What does it really mean? It's not a water quality numeric standard. There's three things that we're talking about. A categorization where actual water bodies are listed under what's called a Category 1, where there is no discharge allowed. We will not write a permit, so there's no discharge in a Category 1. A Category 2 is that we would allow a discharge, but for those geographical areas, that discharge would have to be at the background concentration. And then there is, for all of the other waters, a Level 1 and a Level 2 evaluation as a part of that. Well, how do you get rid of
that? Stop again and say yes. Stop again and say yes on the next one.
Say yes. Thank you, Howard.
And you said that you told it to stop, and then you said, do you really want to stop? And you said, no.
When you turn 65, certain things that are okay. So for the anti-degradation policy, what does it really mean? If you read the verbiage in the rule, the purpose for it is to maintain the current water quality, which doesn't exceed water quality standards. It's better than the water quality standards. But the idea of anti-degradation is to maintain that quality. Why should we let it get worse? Even though it won't violate the water quality standard, why should we let it get worse? And so we have these high quality waters, Category 1 and Category 2, as I've mentioned. And then the other waters of the state that are subject to this Level 1, Level 2 review include all of the other federal actions, such as for a 401 permit, which would include Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issues like dams and pipelines. These are federal actions. A 401 for the UPDES permits. All of our permits technically have an anti-degradation review because we're looking about what that does, and every one of them will have that. A 404 permit is what the Corps of Engineers does when they have wetlands issues and people are involved in the wetlands issue. So these are all under federal actions where we require an anti-degradation review, either a Level 1, Level 2, or you can't discharge, or you have to discharge a background based on calculation. And then the Executive Secretary of the Water Quality Board, Walt Baker, can say, I want one, whether it's required under these rules or not. And so we have the discretion as a division to have that done on any action.
Excuse me, dumb question.
Paul.
Simplistically, then why not just, you said no degradation at all. Why have any except fours? That goes against saying no degradation.
For, I guess the simple answer is because the Clean Water Act allows degradation. And so there could be a school of thought that says that the Clean Water Act needs to be changed, but we operate under the Clean Water Act. I think the thing that really is important for us all to recognize, there has to be a certain amount of degradation.
I think he's saying the opposite, actually. Aren't you saying, why isn't there a loophole to the no degradation?
Well, there are loopholes to no degradation.
Yeah. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, we'll get into that more, I think.
Okay. So if you look at our rules, if you actually go into our rules, you'll see that this is how the rules are written. And you'll see that a Category 1 says, and I've got it in red here on the screen, a Category 1 is all surface waters geographically located within the outer boundaries of the U.S. National Forest, whether on private, public, or private lands. Okay, now what does that mean? That means if you live in Huntsville, you are on a Category 1 watershed, and there will be no UPDES permits written in Huntsville or any of that area, because that Ogden Valley up there is totally enclosed within the outer boundaries of the Forest Service. Is that something that we want to continue? There's a lot of places where people would say, well, that doesn't make much sense because it's a large private area. And so that's an issue that some people have been asking, which means that if anybody wants to have any kind of a sewer, they've got to pipe it out of that basin. A lot of people says, great, let's save the basin. But those are the issues. That's an example of Category 1, Brad.
I was just going to say, on the other hand of this is surface waters, because that basin, instead of piping it out of the basin, everyone puts raw sewage into the groundwater and creates a whole bunch of other issues that, you know, this pushes it in. You know, this, I guess, just standing out there, this has a potential to push stuff to make things worse than actually better. Yeah,
it pushes everything into the ground through septic tanks.
Right.
And that's an issue we want to look at. Mike?
Yep.
Vermont?
Well, what kind of activities don't require permits that may give return flows and
are you talking about UPDES permits? The only areas that are exempt are agricultural return flows, as far as I understand, by law. Everything else that has a pollutant that discharges into the waters of the state to have a UPDES permit.
Surface waters of the state.
Pardon?
Surface waters of the state.
Right.
So the only exception is...
Pardon?
The only exception is agricultural return flows.
That's my understanding. And the legislature put that in law.
Maybe water transfers.
You'll notice then for high quality water category one, category two. Let me go back. We can have other surface waters, the second line in red or the third line in red, which are outside of the outer boundary of the Forest Service, but those are all specifically listed. And so in our rules, you'll see a whole laundry list of these kind of waters. And these are the waters where we're saying we're not going to allow a UPDES permit to be written. And usually the reason is because it's an existing or a potential drinking water source. That's the logic for that. And so as you look into the rules, you'll see that we have all of these different stream segments that are categorized as Category 1, which means no permits. For those of you who are on the federal side of some of the discussion, that's equivalent to a ONRW. And so when people say, well, how come Utah doesn't have any ORNWs, outstanding natural resource waters, we say we have more than any other state. We just defined it differently, which is allowed under EPA's rules, and they have approved that concept.
Well, let me ask you a little complicated question. Under the federal energy policy, stormwater issues for oil and gas, I guess, are excluded. But does the state...
From what?
From regulation.
I'm going to defer to the federal EPA on that one.
But the state can issue stormwater designation, I guess, UPDES is for oil rigs, right?
I'm sure. I think we do. Harry, you're
okay, if I carry on with that, there are tributaries of the Strawberry Reservoir that are completely surrounded by oil and gas rigs, potentially.
And down the road
in 8 years, probably a good bulk of Florence's water is going to come out of the Strawberry Trips, the Strawberry Reservoir, which is a potential drinking. So are you going to address
Well, your question is, do we have UPDES permits for these type of discharges?
Right.
The answer is yes.
Okay. But then,
but they're permit by rule and their best management practices driven. So they don't have a discharge standard.
We have discharges in the basin. I'm more familiar with the basin than what you're referring to on Strawberry, where we have Cockrell Oil Company, for example, is pulling up oil along with a bunch of high TDS water. They have a permit, and they have limits.
But that's not a stormwater.
A stormwater permit. That's a surface water discharge permit. Does that help?
Well, it still confuses me as to the drinking water aspect of it.
If the water is classified as 1C, the same rules would apply no matter what it's classified at. The numeric criteria that would apply to a category 1C would apply as if it were a 3A. So all of those criteria would apply.
I would suggest the exemption you're talking about is by federal statute, and so that's probably not. So it's something completely independent that these guys can't really.
Well, one thing I can answer you from that aspect is, I know DNR and DWQ had a meeting together to talk about how these two agencies can work together, even though we don't specifically have detailed permit limits on these storm water discharges from the oil or gas rigs. But DNR, they are required to inspect these operations. So there were discussions about how our information of the best management practice of stormwater management can be used for their inspection. So that's...
Yeah. Okay, Paul?
Yep. For now.
So that's Category 1. Category 2 is, for an example, in Electric Lake. Let me borrow my little... Thank you. Electric Lake. This is Electric Lake. I think I mentioned to you before at our last meeting, the Skyline Mine was running into water and they had to get rid of it. They were going to flood their mine. So we gave them authorization to discharge into Electric Lake, provided that the concentration of their discharge was equal to or less than the background, which we defined as 80% of the concentrations. And so they were looked like they were discharging into a 300 milligram per liter with maybe 290 or something like that. But we went through that process. The way that process was done is we changed the water quality standard category for Electric Lake, and we actually defined Electric Lake as a Category 2, which allowed them to discharge at background. And then the Deer Creek Mine, we allowed to discharge upstream from the outer forest boundary for 4,800 feet, so they wouldn't have to build a pipeline down the middle of the road. That's kind of what the history of that Category 2 is. So is there a possibility that somebody could go around the Category 1 criteria? Yeah, they could. They could apply to the Water Quality Board to have the category changed so that a discharge could be generated. And that's within our rules to do that. And we have done that. On the other waters of the state, as you can see indicated at the bottom, all of the water, those other waters aren't categorized as a 1 or a 2. They're just not categorized. So since that is the case, we can do permits on all those other waters with no questions other than going through the process. A Category 1, this is where it all starts on anti-degradation. This is when we do our waste load allocations, we've got the flows, we've got the concentrations of the backgrounds, we know what the flow of the treatment plants are going to be or the industrial discharge, we know what the rivers are going to be, and so we go through mathematical calculations, commonly called a mass balance, to determine what would be the level to allow the discharger to pollute up to the standard. And that is a waste load analysis. Those calculations are done to allow a discharger to pollute up to the standard. As a part of that calculation, there are other questions that are asked, like, does the, well, and I'll give you an example. Let's go through the examples. That'd be the easiest way to do it rather than try to explain what they are. And we can actually see those mathematically. For example, one of the examples is this one right here. If a discharge permit renews and there is an increase in the project loading over the prior permits less than 20%, then we don't have to evaluate if that treatment plant has to do alternatives and use different processes. And that's what we call an off-ramp. It's one of Merritt's favorite buzzwords.
I just think it's so sweet that you guys actually call them off-ramps.
Yeah. Well, we can blame EPA for that one because they approved Colorado for that first, and we kind of grabbed it because we liked it. But that's it. We're talking about being on a highway, and the idea was everybody that's in the industrial world or in the discharge world, they want to get on the highway. They're all on the highway of doing a level 2 review, but boy, they'd like to take an off-ramp so they don't have to run off the end of the Embarcadero, for those of you who know San Francisco. So that's what it is. And so if you can't get off the highway, you're going to end up at the end of the highway doing a level 2 review. And there's 8 requirements that are to be looked at. And you may or may not be allowed to pollute up to the standard. The anti-degradation review level 2 may say, okay, to pollute up to the standard. And that would be the result of that review. So the questions that we're faced with today is some of the things that have been brought forth by you and others. One of the things, and we'll take a look at this when I bring up the spreadsheet. We talk about level 2 can allow for pollution creep. For example, if we were to allow a certain discharger to say he only increases it by 20, or instead of that 20% example, by 15%, and then somebody comes in next year and say, well, I want to go another 15 myself, the background is always moving. So do we want to do that, or do we want to put a cap on this background? At this point, we don't have a cap, but that's a question that we want us to struggle with. There's a lot of confusion about, is a level 2 anti-degradation review really an anti-degradation review? It's all in semantics and definitions. We have in our level 1, one of our level off-ramps is, if you've got a water that doesn't have a 3A or a 3B on it, you're off. And a lot of dischargers are saying, great. And a lot of the environmental folks are saying, why? And so we want to open that issue up and see, how do we want to try to move this around? So a lot of folks are saying there's too many off-ramps. And there's been a question that we're not looking at them on a parameter-by-parameter basis. Let me explain that one. If we know that a discharger is going to have a particular parameter in his discharge that is over the water quality standard of the receiving water into which he discharges, that goes in the permit. And the anti-degradation review should be done on that parameter. For example, let me tell you about Central Weber. Central Weber is a big sewage treatment plant getting their waste out of, I guess, Ogden. They're picking up a lot of copper out of the pipes of the town, out of Ogden City. So while the water going in Florence is water for Salt Lake City is great quality and doesn't violate any of the stream water quality standards, what may be coming into the sewage treatment plant does, because of the wasting of the pipes, the copper pipes in the city, because there's miles and miles and miles of pipe. So how does poor Weber, Central Weber, address that? Well, they've got to take a look at copper. And now, if the copper concentration in Central Weber's concentration is higher than the water quality standard, that's a parameter that we're going to look at. But if it were arsenic that doesn't come out of copper pipes, and that arsenic is below the water quality standard, we're not going to do an anti-degradation review on that because there's no chance that it can violate the water quality standard. Does that make sense?
You know, Bill, it does. But just to clarify, in your rule, you talk more about any parameters where the load is increasing, where there's any changes, you know, if it's a renewed permit, assuming. So how do you jive
Yeah.
You jive what you've just said with that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
So I think your rule actually makes more sense when you think about it, even in terms of narrowing the number you need to look at.
If we were looking at our arsenic example for Central Weber and we said, yeah, they're going to be doubling the flow, but the concentration of their flow is going to be exactly the same and it's still going to be below the water quality standard, I think we would say it's not an issue. Even though there's a doubling of the loading, the concentration is still the same.
We'll talk about that.
Okay. So let's talk about the level two review and how this, or the level one review, and then that'll kind of focus on that. This will really set, I think, the discussion when we see how the math goes. And it's not that complicated. I know that you all will be able to understand it. See what your doubt is this. Now if it says, now why won't that work? How about if I hit click? Okay, here we go. You have a copy of this, and if you'd like to look at it and refer to it, that'll be great. Okay, what this says is...
Why don't you blow that back up to size?
Pardon?
Why don't you blow that back up to the size of it?
Okay. I don't see the fly on my screen here.
You do view and zoom?
I'll do what?
Sweet, you're on. Take the from 75 to 100.
Okay, I'll zoom it back up to 100. And then we'll just kind of move it around, okay? Is that better? How's that? Okay, this is Mayfield Town. Everybody know where Mayfield is? It's down by Gunnison. And Mayfield is proposing a discharge into 12 Mile Creek. And 12 Mile Creek is great water quality. It's classified as a 3A water, which means a cold water fishery. It's also classified as 4 for irrigation, so it has a 1,200 milligram per liter TDS value. So it's kind of propitious that we're speaking of TDS with regards to this, because that's our next issue, and so we'll kind of meld them here together a little bit. So the parameter of interest in our water quality standards is TDS, because the town of Mayfield wants to create an RO plant to purify groundwater that's high in nitrate and violates the drinking water standard for wells. So they propose to go ahead and build an RO unit and then use that water to go into Mayfield and Centerfield's drinking water distribution system. Concurrently, they would take that discharge of the RO reject water and dump it into 12 Mile Creek. Well, the RO reject water is high in TDS because they're pulling all those TDS out. It's got to go somewhere, and it goes into the reject water. So the question is, how much will it raise the TDS by putting it into 12 Mile Creek? And so we've taken a look at the upstream conditions, which are basically their critical low flow right here at that 4 value. And we've also looked at the average flow of 12 Mile Creek. And we've taken the 80th percentile of all data that we have on 12 Mile Creek, which is on the high side, and said to them, that's the background concentration. So the first comment that I would make is that 279 is conservative because it's higher than the average. But we would rather err on conservatism. So if you calculate, you end up with 1,100 tons per day or per year of salt, if you will, TDS, coming out of this proposed RO unit that's going to be in Mayfield. And you're going to discharge it where this big red arrow is into 12 Mile Creek and cause the the additional flow to go into the creek from the RO unit, and also the loading, so that you're going to get an increase in flow. So here's the results. Since this is not an existing facility, this is only a planned facility, this whole discussion right in here where I'm moving the cursor doesn't apply. I mean, nothing's going to change because of the past. It doesn't have a current discharge. So we're really just talking about this as a projected discharge. And the projected discharge is designed to flow at 0.22 million gallons per day at about a 20-year future estimated value. So we do all our calculations based out as it's maxed out into the future. And they're suggesting that the concentration of the RO reject water would be around 3,600 milligrams per liter. So if you mix the proposed discharge with the upstream condition, so you basically meld those two flows with their respective concentration, what are you going to get? Well, the answer is that the water is 279 before the discharge, and it's going to go up to 535 after the discharge, and that's at the critical low flow, which again is conservative. And so the question before the Division of Water Quality, because of our rules on anti-degradation, is, and with regards to anti-degradation, is that okay? Does anybody care, or does it matter, that we increase the concentration of TDS in 12 Mile Creek from 279.8 milligrams per liter to 500 and whatever that number is, 35? And there's going to be some people say yes, and there's going to be some people say no. But what do our rules say as written now? And then after we discuss what our rules are written now,
that's the target.
What will it mean then if we decide to change it? Mm-hmm. So, what do our rules say? If you take a look at our rules, and we have a handout on the anti-degradation rules, let's see if we can get you to grab that one.
This document is 5 pages. It's a complete content, just the anti-degradation review policy.
It's a little one, yeah. It's this one that looks like this? So this is out of our rules. This is the anti-degradation policy right out of the rules. And so if you look over on page 1 at the bottom, under B, an anti-degradation level 2 review is not required, and we'll talk about what that review entails, is not required when any of the following conditions apply. And so I've written this Excel spreadsheet to follow the logic of the rule. So the first question is, number one, water quality will not be lowered by the proposed activity. Well, the question is then, on the spreadsheet, will the water quality will not be lowered, yes or no? And the answer is no. It will be lowered. And as a matter of fact, the mathematical calculations show that we're going to have a concentration increase of 91%, because it's going to be going from 300 and whatever to 500. So the answer is no. If that said, if the answer will not be lowered and it turned out to be yes, then that would be an off-ramp. But it didn't mean that, so it didn't apply. Next question, number two, is the effluent limits from a TMDL, from the TMDL section? The answer to that is no, it's not, so there's no off-ramp. Is this a temporary sediment impact without any effect on spawning? It's not a temporary sediment impact, so it's not one of these that fits into a temporary issue. So that's no, so there's no off-ramp. Is it a limited impact? No, it'll be long-term. Is this receiving water, item number 6? Is this a class 3A or is this a class 3B water? The answer is no, it is a class 3 or a 3B water, so there's no off-ramp. Is this a poor quality fishery that DNR says that is poor quality under their guidelines? And while we know that they don't manage it, we're not assuming that they have classified it as a poor quality fishery. So we're saying no, it hasn't been so defined by DNR, and therefore there's no off-ramp. And then the next one, number 8, is this on the 303D list for waters that have an impairment? Is 12 Mile Creek impaired for TDS? The answer is no, it's not. And so there is no off-ramp. Is the current discharge less than the proposed, or is a proposed discharge equal to or less than the current discharge, which means that there would be a net no effect? And the answer is no, so there's no off-ramp. So you can see that what's happening here on this new discharge, there's no off-ramps. And as a consequence, when you finish off number 10 and number 11, you can see that the increase in pollutant loading is greater than 20% because we don't have anything to to compare to, because this is a new discharge. And we know that the discharges going into the stream are not small, and you can see that what those ratios are. So Mayfield doesn't have any off-ramps, and they've got to go through a level 2 review.
Are you interpreting that review as if there are any off-ramps at all, they don't have to do it? Or if you hit one,
if you get one off-ramp, you're home free.
One out of all these choices. Interpret it the other way? If you have one of these that doesn't work, they're out. All need to apply.
The way that the rule's written now, if any one of these... Pardon?
That's a good comment. I'll turn that down.
Send us an email. Don't send it to EPA.
The rule states any anti-degradation level 2 review is not required where any of the following conditions apply. So the comment is not consistent with the language of the rule.
That's the way your rule's written. You're reading it.
Yeah, reading when we were working with the state to develop this rule, the idea was we wanted to have a large universe of waters that would be reviewable. But then the division made the comment that, yeah, but there are some waters where there may be good reasons to exclude them from the universe of reviewable water. So the idea was to think up reasons why a water body maybe should not be subject to the Tier 2 reviewable waters requirements. And this is what they came up with. And even though there's 11, I think that there are... Well, first of all, this number 9 that you have in the spreadsheet has proposed concentration is less than the current discharge concentration. And the rule that has to do with the water body quality. And it's in the rule, number 9 has to do with are the criteria assigned to the water body currently met. And so that's the water body. That number 9 is very similar to number 8. Those 8 and 9 are both looking at situations where there's no sum-off capacity
in number 4.
For that parameter that you're reviewing. And similarly, number 4 falls in that same boat. Number 4, the sum-off capacity's already been allocated. Like there are existing permits that were written to degrade up to the standard. So the new guy coming in, there's no sum-off capacity left to review. So 4, 8, and 9 really are similar. So if you put those... If you combine those, then there really are fewer unique topics that we're looking at than 11. There's sort of some redundancy in some of
it. Is there a situation like on number 3? Is there a situation where you could have an off-ramp anywhere on there and then hammer your spawning?
And then what?
And then greatly impact spawning?
There could be, because one of the off-ramps is it temporary? Let me give you an example. The Yellowstone River comes out of the Uintas, and it flows south into the basin. And on the Yellowstone, there is a small reservoir with a small shallow dam that's used, the water from that is used, it goes to the Moon Electric Company. They've got a small generator. And that thing fills up every 2 years with sediment and branches and stumps and everything else, because it's just a wide spot in the creek. And so they have written the Corps of Engineers for a 404 permit, one of the federal actions that we were talking about. And so we went up, I went up as part of my responsibility several years ago in doing the 404 permits. And we said, well, when you guys are getting, they go right in there with bulldozers, right into the creek, and dig all that stuff up with backhoes and put it in trucks and basically reestablish that basin as a storage basin for the generators, but it's really just a trash basin for everything coming off the mountains. And they said, well, we're going to violate your water quality standards for turbidity, and also we're going to silt the place up so the NERI standard would apply. What are we going to do? And we said, well, I guess the thing we're going to do, we're going to go ahead and give you permission to do that under the certification that the Division of Water Quality writes for a 401 permit, the certification for the 404 permit, and say, you've got to go check with DNR, and you can't silt up the stream as long as there's any kind of spawning going on, and you have to do it fast and get it over with. And that was basically what we did. And so if that were the case and there was a temporary thing like that, it would be an off-ramp. We would not require them to do a level 2 review.
And I'd like to follow up on something Dave said about the length of the list. 11 does seem a lot to me, just generally. But it's not really about the length of the list, in my mind. What it's about with these exemptions and how they've been interpreted as well, some of it may be implementation questions, is this is the very first permit ever issued under this rule that has had to go to a level 2 review. So as a practical matter, we aren't doing...
The trend is toward more and more.
There you go. You're a very positive thinker. So that's our concern with some of these. And from my research, some of these exemptions have, in other court cases, been pushed down and through EPA's own guidance. Like your Region 8 guidance, the 20%, the suggested measurement is 5.
What about the Kentucky Waterways case?
That's a different case with some different findings. But the majority of cases I looked at, with some of these, we've got some problems that are challengeable. So it's not about the length of the list. It's about what's happening with how we apply some of them. So that's where we're at the next meeting. Those are the types of concerns that I'd like to talk about is we're not getting to the intent of the anti-degradation provision by exempting every permit, essentially, that comes through.
I think loading is worth looking at. There are some increases in load that are so huge, they're obviously reviewable, and to go through the work of trying to figure out what the effect on concentration will be is unnecessary, because just by looking at the load, you can quickly decide that it's reviewable. Mm-hmm. But the other side of that coin is that I think loading can miss the key question, which is how is the discharge going to affect water quality and all that. So I think I think Utah should look at ways to look at loading changes to make defensible decisions, but not rely solely on loading changes, because what you really want to focus on is how's the activity going to affect water quality.
Well, when we get into the legal issues, it's time for a break. So food is on the table so that we can get our energy level back up, and then we'll get back into the legal
issues. Somewhere down the road, I'd like to spend a few minutes on how that critical low flow is determined.
Okay. Let's have a break. Bathrooms are down the hall this way. On your left.
I need an answer right now.
Yes.
Listen.